Welcome to Current Affairs. My name is Nathan Robinson. I'm the editor-in-chief of Current Affairs magazine. My guest today is Cory Doctorow, novelist, journalist, activist, pioneering blogger, member of the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Hall of Fame. You can find Cory Doctorow at craphound.com. He also runs the blog Pluralistic. His of his many, many books, one of the most recent, his most recent nonfiction, is How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, and is an upcoming co-authored nonfiction book, Choke Point Capitalism, which will be available from Beacon Press. Cory Doctorow, thank you so much for joining us on Current Affairs.
Thank you very much. Yes, I realized belatedly that I'm just writing a bunch of books with the word capitalism in the title.
Capitalism? Yeah, well, this is what I want to ask you about this, because you seem to... Capitalism seems to be something you're interested in the moment. But I was thinking, what's a good opening question for you? And I think I came up with one that captures the essence of what I want to know from you in particular. So here's my opening question that I'm proud of. What, Cory Doctorow, what could the internet have been that it isn't?
Yeah, well, in a word, you know, pluralistic. That's why I call my blog Pluralistic. So right now, to be a bit Gramscian, we have a very hegemonic internet, right? Where a small number of firms run by mediocre donkeys, no better than you or me, with no business at all running our digital lives, they run everything. They make choices that are undertaken at a scale that is so vast that even if they were the wisest people on earth, those choices would be inadequate. And they are so far from being the wisest people on earth that those choices are extra specially damaging. But, you know, I think that there is a kind of person who observes the internet today and says, the problem is we have the wrong Zuckerberg, right? If only we could put a different Zuckerberg in place, a different Sundar Pichai, a different Tim Cook, then we would be able to perfect these Goliaths that we've built. And I think that, you know, if there's a thing that the techno-utopians of yesteryear didn't understand that would have been very good to have had some thought about, it's that the dawn of the internet coincided with the beginning of the end of antitrust enforcement. The AT&T breakup in 1982 was basically the last really significant action undertaken by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission and DOJ, and that the dead cat bounce was the 7 years of Microsoft antitrust hell that from which they escaped eventually unscathed, and that the dynamism of tech that we were so blithe about, where just we didn't have to worry that there was a giant that was run by a donkey because that giant would fall over and be overturned by two weirdos in a garage who would in turn be overturned in you know, a matter of months or years, that was a highly contingent phenomenon grounded in antitrust enforcement that was on its way out, that had basically been ended, and that as it rolled to a stop, we saw, you know, four or five giant websites take over the internet, and for the internet to just be those five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four.
Yeah. Well, what I'm hoping that you can do for us here is also to sketch a picture for people of what it would look like if things were different, because they weren't always quite this way. You have observed the evolution of the internet from its earliest days. You have watched these giant corporations grow from their infancy. And what alarms me always is you know, the speed with which we get used to things and forget that anything was ever different, or don't think about the way that it could be different. So when you survey the internet today, what do you wish you saw instead of what you see, other than, you know, corporate concentration, but as it manifests in the experience of using the internet?
Yeah, I think that's a good redirection there from some very abstract maunderings of mine to some very concrete stuff. So the early days of the internet were very exciting because the odd points of view were able to coagulate. The people who had a slightly cockeyed way of thinking about the world were able to find one another and do stuff that was just kind of improbable and fun. You know, whether that was like writing a collaborative short fiction or writing software or having philosophical debates or, you know, very silly things. There was an alt news group that was dedicated to like really serious speculation about what it would take to pave the entire earth and race performance motorcycles on it, to people who were collaboratively learning, teaching one another, having heated debates and so on. And so in some respects, you know, that sounds a lot like the internet of today. You can go and find the YouTube rabbit hole that you want to be in, and you can go and find the weird philosophical maundering Facebook group that you want to hang out in. And you could even probably find a Roblox instance where people are building a paved over earth and racing performance virtual motorcycles on it. The difference is that there was a sense that your ability to go on doing this, to find one another, make common cause with one another, solve collective action problems together and do things, was not subject to the whim or forbearance or pleasure of one of a small number of firms. And there was this sense that, like, the problem with, say, blogging was not that everyone was running their own little server or had their own little instance, or that there were so many blogging companies and blogging services and open source blogging tools and so on. The problem was that it was just kind of too esoteric to set all that stuff up, and that the future of blogging and of, you know, self-expression on the internet would be figuring out how to help people whose, you know, hobby was not technology to have a little foothold on the internet, a domain that they could run to make the tooling that they could use to, you know, make secure, well-designed, easy-to-use stuff that they could self-host or that they could host somewhere else. And that in so doing, we could give everyone a place where they could call the shots and they could have some self-determination. They could run their own rules. And the idea was that rather than today's model where we say it's very easy to have a place on the internet, all you do is seek out kind of a manor, you know, like the some people call them feudal keeps, but a historian wrote to me and told me to stop calling it internet feudalism because it's technically internet manorialism, because feudalists had to raise an army on demand from the monarch. So where, you know, today you find a manor, right? You find Apple Manor or Facebook Manor or whatever, and you move in and the local warlord will set you up with a nice place to hang out. And they will, you know, guarantee your safety from the bandits outside of the walls, provided that the bandits don't strike a deal with them and then come after you. Because if it turns out that you know, the lord of the manor wants what you have, they'll just come and take it from you. So you don't have any real protection from them. But, you know, to the extent that you can judge their character, you can get protection from others. And today, you know, our major focus is like, how do we make the lords of the manor better? And back then, our major focus was, how do we have a world without lords of the manor? And in some ways, it's not about how the system works, right? It's about what happens when it fails. Today, if you are part of a community in which the moderation policies fail you, so say you're part of a community in which marginalized people talk about the racial or gender slurs that they endure, and that community is on Facebook, the people who hurl those slurs at you, whose kind of vocation is making your life miserable, they've got all the time in the world to master the kind of pseudo-judicial system by which Facebook decides what content stays up and which content comes down, who gets to keep their account and who gets their account removed for being a bad actor. And they can sit there and like watch everything you type and find the things that you say that cross the line. And they can go to Facebook and say, look, this person used a racial slur. And Facebook, you know, is doing content moderation at such scale that even though the racial slur they used was in the context, I can't believe that someone called me this racial slur. Eventually, if you try it enough, someone at Facebook will make a mistake and they'll shut down your community or kick you off or whatever. Meanwhile, those same people who are kind of bad actor weirdo griefers have got all day long to come up with euphemisms for racial slurs and conduct that is right up to the line of what Facebook or another big platform would call harassment, but without crossing it. Something that is like functionally indistinguishable from harassment, but nevertheless doesn't qualify as harassment under their rules. And they get to act with basically total impunity, right? They get to take advantage of the system. That failure mode is not a failure mode that we had to endure in the same way in a more pluralistic internet, because the moderation was devolved to the people who are running the community, and the community was quite small. And generally, the community was hosted on interoperable infrastructure. And so it was pretty easy for people to leave and take their stuff with them and go somewhere else, or continue to reach out to the people who stayed behind when they left. It was a lot more like, say, Swiss federalism than, say, communism with Chinese characteristics, where, you know, Swiss federalism has got its problems, right? Like anyone who's ever tried to become a citizen while wearing a burqa in Switzerland can tell you that Swiss federalism has some really serious problems. And, you know, communism with Chinese characteristics has some really serious advantages, as anyone who's been lifted out of poverty can tell you. The failure modes, though, of you know, communism and Chinese characteristics is being in a concentration camp in Xinjiang and having your organs harvested. And the success mode of Swiss federalism, or rather the countermeasure in Swiss federalism of a failure on the part of the temporal authorities to do well by you, is that you can just pick up and go to another canton, right? And so in any system, and in any systems critique, there is the question of what it does when it works and the question of how it goes when it fails. And I think that the failure mode of this centralized oligarchic manorial internet is one that is like sort of manifest all around us. It's really awful. And it is a failure mode that we were in large part insulated from under pluralism. We still had to endure, you know, the petty choices of the person whose server we joined, but it didn't matter so much if we decided we wouldn't endure it and we would walk away, because they only controlled such a small piece of our digital lives.
Yeah. I want to get more into this question of governance and who makes decisions and centralization and so forth. But one reason I wanted to talk to you is because I have this kind of, I suppose I'd describe it as a like a fading memory of a land I once visited. If we've been talking in terms of feudal manors and cantons and so forth, I almost call it like a GeoCities world. You know, a world where that was very, very quirky and strange and a little dysfunctional. And there's also been this kind of, I don't know, like cultural flattening that comes with everything having to go through the forms. Like, you know, tweets are very, very diverse, but they're all tweets. And it does seem to me like separate from the governance issue, by having everything on these very few platforms, there has been this kind of stifling of the real quirkiness that I seem to remember of the internet of 10, 20 years ago. And I don't know if that's golden ageism or whether you remember this too.
Yeah, no, I think that that is an excellent point. It's not one I've given a lot of thought to, but you're right that the formalism of a concentrated internet is, as you say, very flat. You know, I gave a talk in about 2003 called "Ebooks Neither E Nor Books," about the fact that like book analogizes really poorly to an ebook, that an ebook could be a million pages long or 3 pages long, right? And it could do things that books couldn't do. I mean, we'd had hypertext forever. And I cut my teeth as a programmer for Voyager, which was like the leading CD-ROM company in the early 90s. So, you know, obviously I was aware of hypertext and all that stuff, but I wasn't really thinking about that. I was thinking about like the literary forms that are possible when text can be updated in real time, the literary forms that are possible when you can work at enormous lengths or very short lengths, or where you can work over long time scales and, you know, serialize things and so on. And there is some of that, right? Like you can see it around in what at Electronic Frontier Foundation we call the public interest internet. So Wikipedia, for example, is probably the most important ebook we have. And I think we can call it an ebook because it's a thing that is meant to replace and also take on the conventions of a codex, right? The Britannica, say. And you know, Wikipedia is like a book and it's a community and it's like, it's a palimpsest, right? Like one of the most important things about Wikipedia's ability to like scrub backwards and forwards through the edit history. It's a, like a philosophical project. It is a political entity. So like periodically when governments contemplate things of sufficient ghastliness, Wikipedia goes black, right? And like goes, takes itself offline for a while. It's like a geopolitical actor. Like that is a weird book, right? Like the point being that like we did have this like kind of formal adventurism that, you know, also things like, I remember when the Norwegian public broadcaster, I think they're called NRK, started experimenting with slow TV, which has since become a kind of forgotten thing, but they were making 11-hour, 14-hour TV programs that were like the kind of badass mutant progeny of like the Firelog TV broadcast on Christmas Day, but it would be like a 16-hour journey on a train from one end of Norway to the other in high definition.
Seems relaxing.
It was relaxing. It was also like interesting at times, and you know, it just had like all of these, all of this sort of formal play. Like TikTok is a TikTok is like a meta form, right? Like, so it's a, you know, it has certain like outer boundaries, you know, how long it can be. And there's even stuff like which music is filtered out by their copyright filter. But within TikTok, there are a bunch of folk practices that emerge really quickly. It's actually really interesting to see. I've got a 14-year-old daughter and, you know, I would never install TikTok on my devices. And I'm kind of scared that it's on hers only because of the surveillance aspects. But the cultural stuff that she exposes me to, right? Like duet as a critical form. So duet is where if I recorded a song, say, if I sang a song or did a dance and then uploaded it to TikTok, someone who liked it could do a split screen with them doing a reaction or doing the same movements or doing movements that made it look like we were in the same room or, you know, something witty or something interesting or something that played off of it. Now it's become like a form of fisking, where like line by line, you will have the person on one side of the frame pausing the person on the other side of the frame and going, let me explain to you why that's bullshit. And let me explain to you why that's bullshit. It's like, it's a very formally interesting thing. But as you say, the constraint, the outer constraint is what TikTok will permit. And we did have a much less constrained realm, or rather we had a realm of much more consensual constraint, where like, if we said, okay, well, this is like, what's in a blog post, you could push the limit. And some people would say, I'm sorry, that's not a blog post. And other people would say, no, it is. But like, there wasn't a tool that put a perimeter around what a blog post could be. And, you know, one of the very first bloggers, Justin Hall, who had a website called links.net, he started blogging before blogging tools existed. And so every one of his blog posts was hand coded and each one looked different. And he had this whole like critical world where he would critique formally the way other people blogged, not like the prose they wrote, but the way that they like laid out their HTML to render their entry on the page and how they were losing some of the expressive power. The thing this reminds me of, there's a superb book by David Byrne from Talking Heads called How Music Works. And he talks about the advent of sequencers and the decomposition of music. And he said, sequencing and multi-track mixing created a system in which post facto, you could make a lot of choices about the recording, right? Things that historically you would have either had to luck into accidentally or premeditate while you were making the performance, or go back and re-perform based on an inspiration that you had while listening to the masters. By single tracking all of the different instruments, all the different vocals, you could then sit down in the edit suite and you could do things with the music. And it was on the one hand, incredibly freeing, but on the other hand, it imposed a formal constraint, because to get clean single tracks, each instrument had to be in the studio playing on its own. And so while you could think of and then realize a way to interplay the drum and the bass, say, the rhythm section, what you couldn't do was have the drum and the bass playing at the same time and having the drummer and the bass player take inspiration from one another and get into a groove. And Talking Heads was jam music. It's dance music, right? If you ever listen to their old live recordings, you know, albums like the name of this band is Talking Heads or Stop Making Sense, especially, it's just got these incredibly long instrumental breaks for people to just rock out. And that rocking out, right, that jamming is what you lose when you let the technology impose a formal constraint on you. And what you get instead is like more editorial freedom, but less creative freedom. And maybe that's where we've arrived at in this world of top-down formal constraint.
Right, because people are very creative within constraint. I mean, you give them, you tell them they can only make 10-second videos, and you will get an astonishing variety of 10-second videos. But, you know, so much of your writing has, over the years, has been trying to draw attention to the ways in which control over certain decisions is taken away from the user, in which the rules of the game are set down by large companies. I mean, and the fact is that, I mean, I don't know if this impression is correct, but it seems to me like the free and open source software movement has sort of stalled a little bit, and people have been shuffled into. I mean, I was shuffled from Firefox to Chrome. In fact, I'm using Chrome right now because Zencastr that we're recording with is not compatible with Firefox. So all my principles go out the window, and I feel myself being pushed, you know, slowly against my will into these forms where I don't have any right to participate in the making of the rules of the game, and where there is no right of appeal for decisions that I disagree with.
Yeah, so you're getting at this thing that I was hinting at before, this the difference between how things work and how they fail. So when the benevolent dictator makes good choices about how your browser is going to work or your software is going to work or what the moderation policies are, that works great, but they're the dictator. So if they make a bad choice, then it fails badly. And you are describing the failure mode. You know, it's funny when you mention the rules and the creativity, you know, obviously, like, you don't have to look at 10-second videos to see how people can be really wildly inventive within a formal constraint. I mean, you can look at the sonnet, right? I mean, we have lots, or the haiku, right? We have lots and lots of highly formalized the tweet, right? And there are lots of circumstances. In fact, I think every circumstance in which you are going to do something with another person requires some constraint, right? Because if there is no agreement, no baseline about how you were going to play, then you're not playing, right? You have to have some, you have to kind of arrive at some consensus about what the core rule set is going to be. Even in the most, there's this kind of game called a gnomic game, G-N-O-M-I-C, or no, just N-O-M-I-C. That's a game where the rules change all the time. There's a famous version of this called Flux, where the rules change all the time. Calvin Ball from Calvin and Hobbes is a gnomic game. But the point is that these are, the thing that makes these games and not torments is that they're consensual. So like a lot of the things that I enjoy a lot are extremely dictatorial, like comedy, right? Comedy is not a democracy, right? You don't get to vote on when the punchline comes. You know, if there's a Shaggy Dog story and the comedian is just drawing it out and drawing it out and drawing it out and drawing it out and doesn't want to, and like making you like sit on tenterhooks for the punchline, you don't get to say, you know, 51% of us in the audience demand the punchline now. But you do have a remedy, right? Which is to leave the comedy club.
Leave. Yeah.
Dungeons and Dragons, right? You don't get to vote on whether or not the dice roll is different, right? Whether you should get like a +4 on that dice roll because the dice was unfair to you. You know, the dungeon master is an authoritarian, but the dungeon master rules by has legitimacy because of the consent of the governed. So the question is about whether or not you can leave, whether you have some consent. And one of the things about scale is that it deprives you of other places to go, because if everybody is under one roof and you leave, there's no one to play with, right? Whereas if we're all spread out in lots of places and you leave, there's going to be someone else to do stuff with. And you mentioned free and open source software and whether or not it's stalled. And it's, the answer to that is complicated and really interesting, because it has both stalled and thrived. And where it has stalled is in the realm of freedom, and where it has thrived is in the realm of openness. So, you know, before the term open source was coined, we just called it free software. The term free software was chosen deliberately and I think mistakenly because of its ambiguity. The idea was to provoke a discussion by saying the software should be free, and the other person is saying, well, how will they make money? And you say, oh, I don't mean free as in beer, I mean free as in speech. And then you could have some kind of debate about it. That's kind of a mistake. And indeed, it's kind of telling that in Romance language countries where there's two different words for free, libre and gratis, they say libre, right? They don't say gratis. And free software is thriving in those places more than it is in you know, the Anglosphere, where we are narrowed down to just using this word free. And, you know, in the early 2000s, a group of people decided that they would try and make free software more palatable by calling it open source and by stressing not the ethical benefits of being open, which is to say aiding the prospect that the user would be able to exercise self-determination, and instead to focus on openness as a kind of descendant of the scientific method, and to say, if your work is subject to peer review, it will be more rigorous, it will have fewer bugs, it will, your own you know, foibles or blind spots will be uncovered by others. The way that this was shorthanded in those days was, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. And so just expose your code to more scrutiny and it will be better. I believe that that's true, you know, for the record. I think there's nothing wrong with openness. But when you stop stressing the ethical benefits and just talk about the instrumental benefits, you invite changes to your norms and practices that can whittle away at the ethical proposition, provided it leaves the instrumental proposition intact. And that's exactly what's happened with free software and open source. There's a theorist of this stuff called Benjamin Hill. He goes by Mako, like the shark. That's his programmer name. And he gave a talk about this at the Libre Planet conference, where he said, you know, at this point, if you're Google, you have software freedom. Right? Like, all the software that you use is open source, it has lots of developers, but you also control it, right? Like, if you want to change how Google's cloud server runs, you just like go in there with the keyboard and make the change. But if you're a user of Google's software, you have open source, right? All of that source code is sitting on GitHub. You can go and look at it. You can even build it and run it on your own server, but your applications won't run unless they can loop through Google, and Google won't change the way it runs on their server infrastructure just because you asked. So they've got freedom and you've got openness. And this is like, this is a kind of endpoint of what it means to have a game that is non-consensual. Is like, it's fine for Google to make choices about its software, but the problem is that you can't really leave Google. Right? You're kind of stuck in its silo. Even if you don't have a Google account, it's almost impossible not to be a Google user in some way. Right. And that means that you've got, you know, you're in the comedy club, but the door is locked and the comedian won't get
punched. Well, that gets us to a point that you make in How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. Mm-hmm. You have in that book a kind of critique of the argument that is usually made or is foregrounded around what is called surveillance capitalism. And what you say is that oftentimes it is talked about as if the problem is that these large tech companies have a lot of private user data and they use it to manipulate us, and they have what you call the, you know, the mind control ray, and they're going to get better and better until they can control us perfectly. And you say that's kind of the wrong thing to focus on, because actually the ability to use this data to manipulate people is a little more limited than people assume. And you say, well, the real problem here, the thing that we need to focus on, is control. Is what happens when, not when a bunch of companies are trying to do targeted advertising, but when you have the internet in the hands of a small number of companies, period.
Yeah. So, you know, take, for example, Google, right? 90% of all searches go through Google. Google is a company that only grew because we stopped enforcing antitrust law. Google is a company that's only made 1.5 successful products in its entire history. They made a search engine and a Hotmail clone. Everything else that they've ever made that succeeded, they bought from someone else, and everything they tried to make in-house failed, right? Like, they never made a video platform. They failed at making a video platform. Google Video was a catastrophe. They had to buy YouTube from someone who was good at making video platforms to make a video platform. And as a consequence, Google now sort of rules the roost. And what that means is that, like, if Google wants to change what you think, it doesn't have to like do sentiment analysis on you and target you with targeted messages and do a bunch of other kind of pseudoscientific stuff out of the fringes of psych research and the stuff that's caught up in the replication crisis. All they have to do is put the wrong information on the front page, right? If you ask Google how long the Brooklyn Bridge is and they give you the wrong answer, you'll probably never know it. And that is a really devastating way to influence our discourse. And it has very, very little to do with spying on us nonsense. And spying on us is harmful, and it's harmful in part because Google, like the other big tech companies, basically fuses with the state and becomes a means by which the state can affect surveillance at a scale that it itself doesn't have the nous or capacity to do. So, you know, if the police want to know everyone who was at a demonstration, you know, they haven't figured out how to get us all to like carry mandatory government location beacons, but they can't ask Google for a reverse warrant, and Google will tell them like the names of everyone who is at a location, right? It's called a geofence warrant. It's kind of a big piece of news these days as the January 6th committee makes lavish use of them. And, you know, it's kind of cool to see people I don't like being caught with these, but I can't help but think that generally speaking, the kind of people who run the kind of event that the January 6th committee is go after people I like more often than people I don't like. And that there's something pretty disturbing there. And so if we focus on the way that they control our discourse, right? The fact that, you know, Apple has decided that the model for computing in the future is that our computer will only run software that has been blessed by a single corporation. And at the same time, even as it's doing this and insisting that it's going to be a benevolent dictator, when the Chinese government showed up and said, hey, you can't make phones in China anymore unless you block all the working privacy tools in the App Store, they were like, I guess we're blocking the working privacy tools. Everyone in China, get used to being spied on by your government. And, you know, if this device were designed so that you could choose software from anywhere, there would be far more scope for iOS users in China to choose a different app store or a different tool and to reclaim some of the privacy that the oppressive state wants to take away from them. You know, the proponents of the surveillance capitalism hypothesis tend to be pretty big on capitalism, and they tend to be sort of pseudo Austrians who think that if you leave the market alone, it will produce efficient allocations because everybody is going to feed information into the market about what they want and how much they're willing to pay for it and what they have and how much they're willing to part with it for. And that through this process, even though it produces some waste at the margins and some weird inequalities, we will get a much better allocation than we would if we were to, say, have a, you know, Politburo decide how our resources are going to be divided. And when they confront Google and Facebook and Apple, less so Apple, they tend to be pretty big on Apple, but Microsoft, say, doing all of this incredibly harmful, creepy stuff just by pursuing free market capitalism with as little regulation as possible, I think they end up in a state of cognitive dissonance. And they say, well, there must be something about this, some no true capitalist analysis I can bring to bear here. And that's where the mind control ray comes in. They say, well, look, you know, the problem here is that Google, who lie with every hour that God sends and every utterance, the one time that Google is telling the truth is when they tell an advertiser how well their tool works at convincing people of stuff. That is the one time we can take them at their word. And when you realize that Google has actually figured out how to take away our free will, well, then you see how the market is broken down. Because if the market is a system for aggregating freely made choices, and Google has taken away your choices by taking away your right to the future tense and your behavioral surplus and all the other kind of esoteric terms for being able to control your behavior by bypassing your cognition, then you realize, oh, we don't have a market anymore at all because people aren't choosing. They're being told what to choose. They're being told what to buy. And, you know, honestly, it's not a harmless difference, right? It's a distinction with a difference, because one of the conclusions that the surveillance capitalism hypothesis advocates come to is that anything we use to kind of shatter Google's strength, right, to break up these big companies into smaller ones, will only do harm because it just democratizes access to mind control, right? Rather than having like five giants with mind control, like, you know, kaiju who we have to build mecha to conquer and put in chains, we've now suddenly like got a bunch of suitcase nukes, you know, all like in every city, and every tin pot dictator has got one. And they say, no, we mustn't weaken them. We must take control of them. You know, we must perfect the Zuckerberg. And until we do, we will all be in danger. And a corollary of this is that almost nothing needs to be done to Apple, because Apple is a company where everything is commodified, and which urges people to only operate on the basis of commodity transactions and not to, you know, have cross subsidy or free and open tools, or, you know, direct interaction between users and software developers. It all has to be mediated by Apple, who want to take 15 to 30% commissions for all the software that changes hands. And they say, well, like, here is a market, right? And the market will work. And, you know, here's Google and or Apple, and Apple stops the bad guys from spying on you, unless they're the Chinese government or, you know, Google, who Apple takes, you know, $12 billion a year to make the default search engine. But in all other cases, you know, the market is working here. And by focusing on mind control and by maintaining this belief in the perfectible market and the wrong Zuckerberg, I think they miss the point, and they counsel something that makes it worse.
And so to get back to where we started and the conclusion that you come to in How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, I mean, you think, and correct me if this is a mischaracterization of you, that the focus here should be on democratization, on pluralism, on taking control out of the hands of unaccountable corporations through antitrust enforcement or through, I suppose, Wikipedia-like participatory mechanisms where the users have some input into the rules. There's some kind of not just a quasi-judicial system where people beg their overlords to forgive them and put them back on the platform if they're booted off, but where there are actual sets of rights people have that are enforceable somehow. So how do you begin to think about what the alternative to the surveillance capitalism model is that you put forth in How We Actually Destroy the Thing That Is the Problem?
So the key here is to understand the political economy of monopoly and who the allies are in fomenting change. And for this, I fall back on the theories of a copyright scholar at Duke University, a Scotsman named James Boyle. And Jamie writes about the dawn of the term ecology in popular parlance. And he says that in the 1970s, before the 1970s, we didn't really use the word ecology. We had a bunch of issues, right? You might care about spotted owls, and I might care about the ozone layer. But we didn't have any sense that we were fighting the same fight. Like, I might think that, you know, your owls were cute and deserve to be saved, but I did not think that the struggle for owls was in any way of a piece with the struggle for ozone, an intact ozone layer. And he said that the term ecology welded together 1,000 disparate issues into a single movement. And the thing about monopoly is that it is not merely a problem of tech. That, you know, the structural factors that created monopoly, the sunsetting of antitrust enforcement, are cross-sectoral. And every sector that you care to name, from the high to the low, from the trivial to the foundational, is gathered into the hands of, you know, sort of between one and five companies. One company makes every eyeglass brand you've ever heard of. They also own all the high street eyeglass retailers and the largest insurer, and they make more than half the lenses in the world. And they've raised the price of eyeglasses by 1,000% in a decade, right? They stole our vision. There's also one company that makes all the cheerleader uniforms, and like one professional wrestling league, and two brewers that make all the beer, two spirits companies, four giant shipping companies who, you know, every time someone said to them, hey, I know you get some real efficiencies of scale when you make your ships bigger, but if you keep making them that big, they're going to get stuck in the Suez Canal. And they just said, like, fuck off. You don't know anything about ships, right? You know, there are so many people who've been harmed in so many ways by monopoly. Right. Whether you're a professional wrestling fan or a beer drinker or someone who needs eyeglasses or someone who's been had their house stolen out from under them by the finance industry. And all of these people are potential allies in this struggle. And I think that when we start naming what we're against, monopoly, and what we're for, pluralism, that we can weld together a social movement. And I think tech is the right place to start for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, the reason tech matters is because it's how we lower our coordination costs. It's how we do stuff together. You know, speaking as someone who's like a veteran of wheat pasting signs advertising protests onto telephone poles, like, I'm here to tell you, if you think that we can organize mass movements without the internet, like, here's a bucket and some wheat paste, go to town and see how you get on. So, you know, we need, like, the internet's the most, not the most important fight we have, but it's like the territory on which those other fights will be fought. But also because digital computers are, like, formally they have this characteristic where they are universal, they're interoperable. Like, we don't know how to make a computer that only runs some programs, right? The only computer we know how to make is the Turing complete von Neumann machine that can run all the programs we know how to write. And what that means is that we can always open the walled gardens, where you can always open a piece of you can always open a hole that allows federation between the existing giant services and new ones that pop up. So you don't have to organize everybody leaving Facebook all at once. People can trickle out if we can add this interoperability layer to Facebook, which we can do through legislation. We can do it through removing the laws that stop us from doing it. We can do it on a small scale, because the thing about adding interoperability is that it requires not a giant firm to build a big monolithic service, but a small tiger team that, like, creates an adjunct to that service. So it's something that can be done with small groups figuring out how to build the stuff that answers their needs. So that formal characteristic, coupled with the internet's salience to all these other fights, makes tech the right place to start and to be the vanguard in a global fight, a cross-sectoral fight against monopoly. Hmm.
Well, I could talk to you for a very long time, Corey, because you know, you've written on so many topics over the years that I've been fascinated by. We didn't even get into the long history of the stuff on. I mean, I grew up on the early days of Boing Boing and reading about all your DRM and copyright stuff. But what I've always liked about your work is that it presents a real vision for an alternate web, you know, a place that is quirky, a place that is pluralistic, a place that is not a Maoist corporatized dictatorship. and you've kept that alive for so long. So it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Current Affairs.
I'm so delighted to have had the chance, not just because these are subjects near and dear to my heart and I am a great admirer of Current Affairs, but also I've been trapped indoors for 3 years with two people who are sick to their back teeth of hearing me talk to this stuff. And so just the chance to talk to someone who's actually interested in it is such a blessing. So I appreciate it and I thank you.
Trouble in transit, got through the roadblock. We've been knitting with the crowd. We got computers, we're tapping phone lines. That ain't allowed. We dress like students, we dress like housewives, or in a suit and a tie. Changed my hairstyle so many times now. Don't know what I'm